We're going to continue our discussion of God's sovereignty, and we've been specifically looking at the idea that God is immanent. He is truth. I can't stress enough how important the idea that God is truth really should be in our lives. This idea that God is truth means that God is faithful. If you look at Revelation, the 19th chapter, and verse 11, as John is describing everything that he sees in heaven, he turns his attention to God. He says in Revelation 19 at verse 11, and this is from the English Standard Version, he says, "I saw heaven opened. Behold, a white horse. The one sitting on it is called faithful and true. And in righteousness, he judges and makes war." This is God. And God, above all things else, is always, forever, true to his nature. He cannot change. In Numbers, the 23rd chapter, at verse 19, again, the English Standard Version, Moses says, "God is not man." Now, they kind of let that sink in. God is not man that he should lie. Or the Son of Man, that he should change his mind. Has he said, and he will not do it? Or has he spoken, and he will not fulfill it? The essential error, it seems to me, that people make when they think about God is that they think about God like us, and he's not. He is just different than we are. We've been through the election cycle, and you know, we've heard people say, "I'm going to do this right after I'm elected," and they, it seems like they forget after they're elected, and they don't do it. And then somebody asks them a question about, "Why did you say you were going to do this and then you didn't do it?" And they act like you're doing something terribly wrong just because you asked them the question. You probably read the story about Daniel. It's a wonderful book. And we've talked about it on a number of different occasions. Anyway, Daniel is in a position of great authority under Nebuchadnezzar and then under Cyrus, when Cyrus defeats Nebuchadnezzar and kind of inherits all of the slaves that Nebuchadnezzar has. Now Daniel is an outstanding individual. Nevertheless, he's a slave. He has been deported from Judah and brought to Babylon, but he still prays to God. He's risen to a position of authority in Babylon, and the Babylonians kind of resent him. Same thing happens when Cyrus defeats Nebuchadnezzar and he takes over. And because Daniel holds this position of prominence, the minor officials, they're called satraps. What a great name. But they're called satraps. And they resent Daniel. So they conspire against him. They know that Daniel prays every day. So they go to Cyrus and they say, Cyrus, you need to make a law that nobody can pray to any god except you. You need to write it down and you need to sign it. What was the big deal about writing it down and signing it? They knew that Cyrus liked Daniel. And they didn't want Cyrus to go back on his word. They didn't want Cyrus to renege on what he had said. So they said, Cyrus, write it down. And then you sign it. Because they knew Daniel was going to pray anyway. It was a conspiracy. But it demonstrates something to us. People have a tendency not to keep their word. I can remember a time when I was a little bit older than Brody, but I was still young enough that I thought every time my dad said something that that was gospel truth. I had never seen a time when my dad said something was going to happen that it didn't happen. Now, I got a little older and I began to understand that sometimes dads, with the best of intentions, say that they're going to do something and they intend to do it, but circumstances prevent them from doing it. God is not like that. There's never a way that you'll be disappointed in God. But people think that God is like man, that he says things, but he's not going to carry it out. 2 Peter, the 3rd chapter, verse 4. The scoffers would say, where's the promise of his coming? Since the fathers fell asleep, all things continue as they were from the beginning. And Peter says, wait a minute. Number one, you're just willingly ignorant that God has executed judgment in the past. Did you forget about the flood? It's not true. When you say all things continue as they were from the beginning, that's just not true. God has executed judgment in the past. He will execute judgment in the future, but we sometimes think that God is like us. And God is, well, he's not going to carry through on his promise. 2 Timothy, the 2nd chapter, verse 11 beginning. The apostle says, this saying is trustworthy. If we have died with him, we will live with him. This saying is trustworthy. If we have died with him, we will live with him. If we endure, we will also reign with him. If we deny him, he'll deny us. If we're faithless, he remains faithful. He cannot deny himself. That's interesting. It makes me think about the fact that for God to lie would be a moral impossibility. God cannot lie. So I started thinking about moral impossibilities. How do we make moral decisions? What's the process that we go through? Anytime we're faced with a decision, we scan the entire field that is before us, and from all of the options that present themselves, we choose one. Isn't that right? We choose based on what we've seen. And there are times when we survey the field, there are just some things that, well, they're probably options, but they're just, nobody's ever done that. Nobody does that. I've been in situations where I was out of money and I needed to purchase something. So I surveyed the field. What can I do? It's possible that I could go rob a Quick Stop. I could get money that way, but that was a moral impossibility. That just, it was out there. I could see that it could be done, but nobody did that. Well, it turns out that for some people, that's an option. It's not an option for me because I don't run in that crowd. In the crowd that I run with, nobody does that. But once that enters the realm of possibility, people start viewing that as a viable option. I have a feeling that before World War II, people never really thought that it was a possibility that you could kill 8 million people just to get rid of Jews. I think that was a moral impossibility. It just wasn't. It wasn't in the field of vision. And then Hitler did it. And do you know today, if you ask people, is that a moral impossibility? Most of us would say yes. But there are people who would say, no, that we could do that. The Chinese did it. They killed people just because they stood against them. The range of what's morally possible changes for men. That's really surprising. And this is an aside. This is something that occurred to me as I was thinking about this notion of moral impossibility. You know, it's also possible for us to think that some things are so good that nobody lives that way. I have a feeling that we would think that about what Jesus did. Going to the cross, dying for other people, dying for your enemies. And we would say that's a moral impossibility. Nobody does that. Nobody had ever done that before Jesus came. And so Jesus elevated us. I think that's one of the reasons why Jesus had to come to the earth. He could have died in heaven. He could have, God could have killed him there. He didn't have to come here. But he came here to make it morally possible for us to even consider some things that are so good. Have you ever thought about that? Do you know anybody? Now I'm talking about people that are old enough to act on their own. Do you know anybody who never had a bad thought? Till Jesus came, I'd have said no. Never been a man like that. There have been a lot of people who didn't act on their evil thoughts, but nobody ever lived who didn't ever have an evil thought. Jesus came and he proved men can be that. So that's just an extra when we think about moral impossibilities, but it is important for us to understand that there are some things that just can't happen. Second Peter, the second chapter and verse 14. First John, the ninth or the third chapter at verse 9. In both places, the apostles say that Christians cannot sin. Now, wait a minute. When we're talking about the field of moral impossibilities, I know Christians can sin. But you can't be a Christian and do that. It's contrary to your nature. If you put on Jesus, you cannot sin. It would be so contrary to your nature that you wouldn't even think about doing it. Well, you know what? In Titus, the first chapter, beginning at verse 1, this is what the Apostle Paul says. Paul, servant of God and apostle of Jesus Christ, for the sake of the faith of God's elect and their knowledge of the truth, which accords to godliness and hope of eternal life, in which God, who never lies, promised before the world began. We're familiar with promises, and we sometimes think that God thinks like we do, and so it's a promise, but we're not absolutely sure that God is going to keep it. But here's the first thing. God never lies. He has never lied in the past, and he never will lie. Do you know anybody who could say that other than God? See, we think that that's so good that we think that's a moral impossibility. God has to have at some point lied. But he didn't. Hebrews, the sixth chapter. This is important. Because it reminds us of how secure we can be when God says, I have prepared a place for you. Hebrews, the sixth chapter, beginning of verse 16. Men verily swear by the greater, and an oath for confirmation is to them an end of all strife. You know, when you go to court and you put your hand on the Bible, do you so solemnly swear that you will tell the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth? You're swearing an oath. This is what he says. Wherein God, willing more abundantly to show unto the heirs of the promise, the immutability of his counsel, confirmed it with an oath. That by two immutable things in which it was impossible for God to lie, we might have strong consolation who have fled for refuge to lay hold upon the hope that is set before us. And there's a picture there of the cities of refuge. If you had committed murder, you could flee to a city of refuge in the Old Testament system, and you would be safe there in that city of refuge. You could never leave it, but you would be safe there from those that would execute a vendetta against you. You kill one of mine, I'm going to kill you. This was the city of refuge. Let's think about God and how a promise and an oath, two immutable things, help us to understand when God makes a promise to us. This is in Genesis, the 12th chapter, verses 2 and 3. God made a promise to Abraham. And you know, that promise should have been enough. And in many ways, it was enough. God told Abraham to do something, and Abraham did it based on this promise that God made to Abraham. I'll make you a great nation. I'll bless you. I'll make your name great so that you will be a blessing. I will bless those who bless you, and him who dishonors you will I curse, and in you all families of the earth will be blessed. So we know that that promise has three parts. I'll make you a great nation. I'll give you a land, and in your seed, all nations of the earth will be blessed. Jesus is going to come. He's going to be a Jew. He's going to come from your seed. Abraham got up and went based on this promise that he got from God. Abraham got up and went. Now, Abraham had trouble remembering that God was going to keep his promise. And there were times when he thought, you know, maybe I need to help God out with this promise because he's made a promise. And here I am. I'm 90 years old. I don't have kids. And God said he was going to make me a great nation. And in my seed, all nations of the earth will be blessed. And so Abraham wavered a little bit, but God understood that. And then God said to Abraham, I want you to take your son, your only son, the one that you have to have in order for me to make the seed promise come true. I want you to take your son, and I want you to kill him. I want you to make a sacrifice with him. Well, Abraham, I'm sure he questioned it, but he was willing to do that too. And if you look at Genesis, the 22nd chapter, and you begin reading at verse 15, you find what God's response was to Abraham. Abraham had faith. I'm sure that he worried about it, but he was ready to sacrifice Isaac. The angel of the Lord appeared to Abraham the second time from heaven, and he said, by myself I have sworn, declares the Lord, because you have done this and have not withheld your son, your only son, I'll surely bless you. I'll surely multiply your offspring as the stars of heaven and as the sand that is on the seashore. Your offspring shall possess the gate of his enemies. Your offspring shall of all the nations of the earth be blessed because you have obeyed my voice. God made a promise to Abraham. And Abraham believed the promises. That's the first immutable thing. The second immutable thing that God did was he swore by himself. I promise you, and I swear I'll keep it. Abraham knew that God could not lie. I know that God cannot lie. God promised that some things were going to happen. We'll talk about them. We'll talk about a promise of judgment. We'll talk about a promise of heaven. But I want you to understand how much you can rely on what God says. Two immutable things. Promise and an oath. God makes the morally impossible, at least on the good side, possible. We can live the way that God wants us to live. Put him on in baptism. He is the greatest king that you can imagine. He's the one that you want to serve. Yeah, I had my favorites in the election. But they can't hold a candle to God. I'd rather have God as my king. I wish he could be elected governor, but he can't. I wish he could be elected president, but he can't. Sometimes I think it's because we expect presidents not to always tell the truth. My favorite president didn't always tell the truth. He lied. I'm just not sure we're ready to have somebody like God be our king. Except in the sense that we can serve him for eternity. We want you to think about that. We want you to take the opportunity to ponder whether this is the God that you want to serve. It's a frightening thing in a way. But in a way, it's the only thing you can count on.